chapter 3, and this is where we were several weeks ago. We are over, on the bottom of the first page, small letter B, New Testament teachings, and we went through Romans 13, let every person be subject, this is the first page, the bottom, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Those that exist have been instituted by God. Whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And that teaches us that we should be obedient to government, and that's certainly true as Christians. We need to understand that. But it raises the question, is it ever right to disobey the government? And that I didn't put in the outline, but I've given Clyde an additional 2 pages on that question. And was the American Revolution justified, or was it wrongful disobedience to the King of England? And I'll just put that in as a P.S. next week. We'll talk about that. But I think we're going to try to finish this outline today that you have. Okay, now we're over onto the second page. Number three on the second page. I stopped the last time I was here on number 2. Government cannot save people or fundamentally change human hearts. That's the task of the church and Christians, to preach the gospel of good news of Jesus Christ. Personal salvation is the work of God, not government. So that was number 2. Now number 3, and let's see, I'm going to click that off for now. Okay. Number 3, principles for a right relationship between church and state. Now, if you have a Bible, or if you just want to listen to this verse, the decisive statement that kind of sets the stage for this whole discussion is in Matthew 22:21. People brought Jesus a question. They were trying to trap him, and they said, "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" And they thought this would trap him, because if he said, "Oh, it's lawful to pay taxes to Caesar," then the Jewish people would be upset, because you're supporting this evil Roman government that's oppressing us. And they thought he would alienate his followers among the Jewish people. But if he said, no, you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar, then, of course, the supporters of the Roman government would say, you're preaching insurrection, you're a traitor, you're opposed to the government. So no matter what Jesus did, they thought they had him in a trap. And he said, bring me a coin. And they brought him this denarius. And he said, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. And so then Jesus said this in Matthew 22:21. He said to them, therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. Now, this is very significant. In the Old Testament, the government of the people under Moses, for instance, there wasn't any distinction between the things that belonged to the civil government and the things that belonged to God, because if you lived in the nation of Israel, it was all the same. You had laws of sacrifice that, you know, you had the sacrificial and worship system attendance at the temple and the Jewish festivals, all those religious things, that was all mixed up together with laws about don't steal and don't murder and those things that the civil government would normally deal with. So the government over the people of God and the government over the nation were the same. Moses, David, they're over the whole deal. But now Jesus, in saying there's some things that belong to Caesar and some things that belong to God, He's marking out a distinction in that there are two realms there. And the implication is paying taxes, that's something that belongs to Caesar. And that was implying then, if Caesar's inscription is on that coin, well, pay taxes to Caesar. And of course, Romans 13 follows that up and says explicitly, you must pay taxes. Romans 13, 6 or 7? But then there's another area of things that are God's, and the implication is Caesar shouldn't touch those things. Well, I see Clyde here. Does anybody need one of these outlines? Anybody not have an outline? No, we're good. Okay. Now that's a very significant thing, and it means point A, the church should not govern the things that are Caesar's. That means the church shouldn't appoint rulers in the government. And I think that means that the popes in the Middle Ages, who selected the Roman emperor, were wrong in doing that. That wasn't the role of the pope or any church official to select a government official. And you see that as that's worked out in the New Testament when Paul writes to different churches about church officers. For instance, when he writes to Timothy or Titus about elders, he lists, you know, do this, do this, do this. He doesn't give any indication that the city officials in Ephesus should choose the elders of the church. That would be unthinkable. And he doesn't give any indication that, or the New Testament doesn't give any indication that the governing officials in Jerusalem had authority to choose leaders in the church. The apostles were the leaders, and then they chose out others to help serving tables, maybe the early deacons. So there was a difference. So the church shouldn't try to govern the things that are Caesar's. But the civil government should not try to govern the things that are God's as well. Now, see, there's no distinction between things that belong to Caesar and things that belong to God in Muslim teaching, for instance. If you have a Muslim nation, at least many Muslims want to impose a requirement that you have to attend the mosque and carry out these prayers five times a day and follow Islamic teachings if you live in a strict Islamic country, because there's no separation between what we would call things that are government things and things that are church things. So for us, that means that there should be a difference. Now, Jesus didn't spell out what things belong to one realm and what things belong to the other, but he laid out the principle that there's a difference. And it separates us from the Old Testament as well, the Old Testament period. And so I think that provides an answer to people who say, well, why don't you require people to carry out these dietary laws? Or why don't you require people to follow all these punishing people who take the Lord's name in vain, or things like that? We don't think that government should do that today, because there's a distinction between the things that belong to Caesar and the things that belong to God. Point C, I still think that civil government should support and encourage churches and bona fide religious groups in general. So even though there are these two realms, should government give some support to churches, such as giving tax-exempt status to churches? Scottsdale Bible Church doesn't pay any property tax on the land that we're meeting in this morning. And Scottsdale Bible Church, I think it's incorporated in the state of Arizona, but it doesn't pay any income tax on the donations that people give. Because there's a protection from that. Then why is that? It's because the society has decided that churches in general are good for the society. So there's a general benefit, and if you're a Baptist church or a Bible church or a Lutheran church or a Catholic church, or if you are a Buddhist temple or a Mormon church, I guess, or a Jewish synagogue, you have all those benefits as well. It's given to all religious groups without differentiation. And I think that's good, because the society thinks this is good in general for religions to function in a society. Sadly, that view of churches is being obscured in the United States now, so that in city after city, there are challenges to churches where they buy a land and then they want to build on it, and the city won't give them zoning rights to build or occupancy rights to occupy their building, because they don't want to give up the tax revenue. So there's a hostility in some cases in the United States, and Margaret and I are very familiar with a case in Evanston, Illinois, where a church that we were part of bought a building in Evanston, and to get around renting. They'd been renting meeting space at the high school for several years, and they got a building. They bought it, and the city wouldn't give them an occupancy permit, and they had to go to federal court to get a legal case that dragged out for years in order finally to get the federal government to say, Evanston, you shouldn't prohibit the church from meeting here. So churches have sometimes, or cities have sometimes neglected that. But in general, I think it's right for the government to support, give some support to religion in general. And supporting military chaplains, for instance, is another example of that. That's not a wrongful control of the church by the government, but it is giving support. The most difficult church-state questions arise when people disagree over whether something belongs to the realm of the church or the realm of the state. And so in the early church, the government said you have to bow down to Caesar. This is part of being a loyal subject of the Roman Empire. It's a political question. And the church said, no, wait a minute, that's idolatry. That's worshiping Caesar instead of God. We won't do it. And many Christians lost their lives, but there was a difference as to whether that was something that belonged to the political realm or the religious realm. And I think Christians were right about that. That comes up in the United States. For instance, Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe that you should give blood transfusions. But then what about a child who is very ill and needs a blood transfusion? Or the child will die. The courts have consistently in the United States said protecting the life of a child is part of that realm that belongs to Caesar. And we're going to enforce the law. That isn't an area of worship. Of course, it comes from your religious belief, but it's not essential to your worship or the doctrines you hold. That is, it falls rather in the realm that belongs to Caesar. And courts will take children forcibly from Jehovah's Witnesses' parents and administer blood transfusions to them to save their lives when that's necessary. And I think that's a right decision. I think that the courts have done that and decided that protecting the life of a child belongs to Caesar and not to the realm that belongs to God. But the disputes are where you have questions about what realm it belongs to. Point four, all governments should establish a strong and clear separation of powers. I don't have supporting material under this, but I just want to say that when God sets up systems of government in the Bible, there's never just one person in charge. That is, in the Old Testament, you had three offices. There was the king, but there was also the priest, the high priest, and there was three offices, main offices in the Old Testament. The king, the priest, and the prophet. So that the prophets and the priests could rebuke or correct or bring influence to bear to safeguard against the abuse of power by a king. And in the New Testament, you have a separation of powers in churches because every time you have church government, you have not just one person in charge, but you have more than one. You have plural elders in the New Testament churches. And Jesus, when he left the earth, didn't leave just one apostle in charge of the church, but he left 12. So there's kind of this idea of a separation of powers in that you have multiple people in charge of organizations when God has set up governments in the Bible. And so I will argue from that to say there's a pattern there, and then also we see a pattern through history that when people get too much power, they abuse it. And so unchecked power doesn't have enough accountability for leaders, and they become corrupt, and they become selfish and take everything for themselves and their friends and their family. So what happened in the United States when people were setting up the government of the United States, there was a strong desire to separate, and put power of government, which is so easily abused, to put power in different groups. So what do we have? We have the president with the executive branch. He carries out the laws, but he doesn't pass the laws. The Congress passes the laws. That's the legislative branch, and then who interprets the laws? The judicial branch. So there are three branches of government. Not only that, but there's a separation of power. So you can't have a military leader just take over the army and control the United States. Why not? Well, because the military is ruled not ultimately by a general, but by a civilian, the Secretary of Defense, and then the President, who is elected by the people. And then there's another thing. You know, there's some countries, like some Latin American countries, if you take over the army, you run the country. But that doesn't happen in the United States because the army in the United States can't carry out any police functions within the country. It's prohibited from doing that. The police functions are carried out primarily by state and local governments. So who's in charge of the Scottsdale Police Department? It's the mayor in Scottsdale. And is there any higher authority? No, I don't think so. And who's in charge of the Phoenix Police Department? Mayor of Phoenix. And so with other cities around the United States. And so there's a separation of powers to prevent any group from... You can't take over the Army of the United States and have the police in Scottsdale answer to you. Does that make sense? It's a separation of powers. There's a separation of powers in that there's some powers given to the national government and some powers given to the state governments and some powers given to local city and county governments. So there's separation of powers to prevent anybody from getting too much power and running away with it and becoming corrupt and oppressing the people. Interestingly enough, there's another element in the First Amendment to the Constitution that was a way to separate powers and divide power in the United States, and that is freedom of the press and freedom of speech and the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. You think, oh, that's kind of obscure and vague. That doesn't mean too much to us. But those Chinese lawyers who stood here 6 weeks ago, they don't have those freedoms. They don't have them to a large extent because the press freedom is restricted. When we were in China, somebody sent me an article about some human disaster that had happened in China. And I click on the link and my computer screen goes blank. And somebody sent me something else, said, hey, look at this YouTube video. And I click on the link and I can't get on YouTube. Screen goes white. Why? Because the Chinese government restricts freedom of the press and freedom of speech. You have freedom to say whatever you want to, but as Barry Asmus so classically says, they believe in freedom of speech, it's just not freedom after the speech. So, and the right of the people peaceably to assemble, that is what's behind this oppression of churches in China. They don't want all these Christians getting together. It provides a threat to government power. And actually, that's increased in the last few weeks, if you've followed news reports. Sadly, large, large churches being shut down, people being put in prison. So those are protections against the tyranny that government can come to when it gets too much power. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom to assemble and to petition the government for grievances. Those are protections that fall under separation of power. And there's another one. Historically, the Second Amendment to the Constitution, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, provided an additional level of protection against a tyrant. They didn't want a tyrant to come and take over against the will of the people, so they figured, hey, if everybody has guns, it'll be a lot harder for a government to take over against the will of the people, because the right of the people to protect themselves is a separation of power. So there are lots of ways in which there's separation of power built into the government of the United States, and we even see it today. I was just thinking that this morning. President Obama was elected with a significant majority of votes, and his party, the Democratic Party, now controls both the House and the Senate. But even so, he's not able to get everything done that he wants to get done. Why? Because the minority power party still retains some power. And there's a freedom of press, so there are people who have various viewpoints that are criticizing him. And so there's a tug and push and back and forth. And so in a way, the separation of powers means the government, even the leader of the government, the president, can't do whatever he wants. He's got to get other groups in the country to go along with him. So that's an important principle, a separation of powers. Number five, the rule of law must apply even to the rulers in a nation. That is, the king isn't the highest authority in the nation. The law is. And the classic example of this, before I get to that passage there, the classic example illustrating this in the Bible is 2 Samuel 11, where David, the greatest king in the history of Israel, David, who had military conquests and triumphs and success wherever he went, David sinned by committing adultery with Bathsheba and then having her husband put in a place in battle where he would be surely put to death. David began to think he was above the law. The law didn't apply to him. But what happened? The prophet Nathan came to David, and in that story in 2 Samuel 11, Nathan tells this parable about the man who has many sheep, and he takes the sheep, steals it from his neighbor who had only one sheep. And David said, "That man shall be put to death." And Nathan pointed at him and said, "You are the man." In other words, David, you are not above the law that God has given to the nation. You are the king, but you are under the law, and you are accountable to the law. And that was established as a principle quite clearly in Deuteronomy 17 that I put here on the outline. When he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that's the king, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life. See, he has to copy it himself by hand and then read in it so he can know again and again that he is subject to God's laws. That he's not above the law. He can't make any law that he wants. That he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of his law and these statutes and doing them. That his heart might not be lifted up above his brothers. And that he might not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left. So that he may continue long in his kingdom and his children in Israel. Deuteronomy 17, 18 to 20. So the law must apply even to the rulers. And it's interesting, I think, that when the government of the United States was set up, the question was, who shall have the highest power in the nation? Well, they didn't want a king. They just came out of that situation in England. They didn't want a king. Well, should we just have Congress have the highest power? Well, they didn't answer that Congress would have the highest power. What about the president? Should the president have the highest power? No, they didn't choose the president or the Congress or the court. The solution that the founders of the United States had to who shall have the highest power in the nation was not any person, but a document, the Constitution. And the Constitution was to be above the president, above the Congress, above the Supreme Court. It was to be the final decider of disputes and to establish the principles by which the government should be founded. And so that was the idea, that the rule of law must apply even to the rulers in a nation. Now, when Barry Asmus and I go to different countries, as we've read about different countries, one of the characteristics of countries that remain trapped in poverty is that you have rulers who decide that they are above the law and they can favor their friends and their relatives, and they can violate the law and get away with it. They get away with it, but what happens is, do you want to invest in a business in that country where one of the relatives of the king can violate his contract with you and you take it to court and you know you're going to lose because the relative of the king or the prime minister or the president or the dictator, that he gets privileged status. That is, that's people above the law rather than the law applying to everybody in a country. And of course, that traps a nation in poverty. So this is an exceptionally important principle. The rule of law must apply even to the rulers in a nation. Now, whenever a government official in the United States is convicted of bribery or convicted of some other crime, we see that principle working. That you can be a congressman or you can be a judge in a court, and if you commit a crime, you still are accountable to the law. And to the extent that that system works correctly, we should be thankful for it, because it protects us against tyranny. Number six, the purpose of government is to serve the people, not to be served by the people. This principle is the key to solving the problem of corruption in many, many countries of the earth. The purpose of government is to serve the people, not to be served by the people. I think Barry talked about this because I talked to Barry yesterday, and two days ago, and he enjoyed being here a lot. I think that he mentioned that he had said this, but I'm going to repeat it anyway for those of you who weren't here or just for the sake of driving home an important point. What you have is a good example in 1 Samuel 12. I've put that here in the outline. Samuel comes to the end of his term as judge, judging Israel. And Samuel says, here I am. He's standing before the people. And he says, here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you. And they said, you have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hand. So Samuel was a good example. He didn't use the power of his government office to enrich himself. He didn't defraud the people. He didn't take an ox or a donkey. He didn't take a bribe. But just four chapters earlier, Samuel had warned the people that if they get a king, what was going to happen was the king was going to take, 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 take. So let me read the warning of how a king will misuse his authority. 1 Samuel 8, 11 to 17. These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards. He will take your male servants and your female servants. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. That is the picture of a corrupt government. He will take, he will take, he will take, he will take, he will take. Take more and more for itself. Government has the power to take from the people. And when it has that power, there's the temptation to abuse that power more and more. Now, one of the things that Barry Asmus and I talk about when we go to talk about principles that lead to wealth or poverty within whole nations is this principle. Is there an assumption in the minds and hearts of the people that people in government should serve the people of the society? Or is there an assumption that if you get government, of course, you'll take it for your own personal benefit? And I carry around something I cut out of a newspaper in England last summer, where the president of an African country just died. The country was impoverished, and he had probably billions, at least hundreds of millions of dollars in his personal accounts, and owned property in London, property in the United States, all over. He will take, he will take, he will take, he will take. And, in fact, this book that I use often, David Landis, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, says that when in many African countries today, the very best and brightest students go to England, go to France, go to the United States for education, and they come back, and what do they want to do? Do they want to be doctors? No. They want to be engineers? No. They want to be working in business? No. Do they want to be lawyers? No. Not in private practice. The one job they all want is to work in government, because that's where the money is. It's just assumed if you work for the government, you will take for yourself, you'll get rich, and your relatives will get rich, and your friends will get rich, and of course, that destroys a nation. But here it is in Samuel. The purpose of government is to serve the people, not to be served by the people. Yes, I think government officials should be paid for their work, paid reasonably for their work, but they shouldn't be allowed to take bribes or anything else. So that's number 6. Now, I will pause there for a minute before I go on to the next, because the next one is a little bit of a challenge. Do you want to interact on points 3, church and state, 4, separation of powers, 5, the rule of law has to apply to the rulers, or 6, the purpose of the government is to serve the people, not to be served by the people? Carol Barmore.
You made a statement about Muslim nations,
yep,
that they had to bow down for prayer.
Well, in some nations, there's that expectation or requirement. Saudi Arabia, for instance.
It is a requirement.
What if you're
not of that belief?
Yeah, if you're a tourist or a foreigner, I think you're excluded. But if you're a resident, as I understand it, there's pretty much,
yes,
a compulsion to follow the Muslim religion. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now. Now, there are some secular Muslim nations. Turkey, for instance, 99% Muslim, and has tried to separate out the Islamic beliefs from the government. And to some extent, I think Indonesia is that way. So it isn't consistent. But in many Muslim nations, there is an idea that there's a difference between Caesar and God. Now, E.G., we've got to get the... JT is working this morning.
Do they consider themselves a theocracy?
You know, would they call themselves a theocracy? I don't know. I would say probably. This is God's law and everybody has to follow it, but it's in the religious realm as well as the civil, secular realm. But I'm not sure. Okay. What else? Yeah, what's your name?
Lisa.
I just, before number 4... Now, you mentioned that there was not a real strong and clear separation of powers with the kings, the bad kings of the Old Testament. What about with the good kings?
Yeah. Okay, so there are two things going on there, Lisa, in the Old Testament. There is some separation of power in that you have the king and you have the prophet and the priest. So the prophet and the priest teach God's law. The prophet says, "This is the word of God to you, O king, today." And so there's some balance or some check on the power of the king. It's not 100%. And the evil kings, of course, they disobey what the prophets and the priests say, and they go their own way, or the prophets and the priests become corrupt, and then God judges the nation. So the system can break down. But there was some hint of separation of powers there anyway. Yeah. What else? Diane.
Thank you. By President Obama having the czars that he has, is he bypassing some of the protection that we have built into our government?
It worries me. I think so, Diane. I think, and the criticisms of those czars have been, wait a minute, aren't these presidential appointments at least supposed to be approved by the Congress or by the Senate, and rather than just appointed when they have so much authority? And I'll tell you, for our whole lives, in every nation in which we live, always we have to be on guard against excessive concentration of power in any one branch of government. When I come to the courts, I'm going to say that's a huge problem with the Supreme Court here in the United States now, but it's a problem with the executive branch now too, and something to be worried about. Yeah, at least it seems to me. I'm also worried about the federal government taking over more and more and more things and the states not having the powers that were originally intended for them to have under the Constitution. It's a tendency of human government always to try to get more power for itself, and it should worry us. Yep, Ron? What's your name?
Doug. In relation to the EPA now... And the Obama administration came out this week saying that we may not do it through the treaty. to
the carbon reduction.
Yeah, that the EPA may just impose it.
Yep.
My question is, can't we just defund the EPA, and why couldn't we?
Yeah, the Environmental Protection Agency, Doug, you're right. The Environmental Protection Agency issued this ruling, which unfortunately was supported by a Supreme Court decision 2 or 3 years ago, saying carbon dioxide is a pollutant. Well, that's news to me. I exhale carbon dioxide many times per minute, and it's necessary for all green plants to grow. And so I didn't think it was a pollutant, but when the Supreme Court says, yes, you can rule it as a pollutant, then the Environmental Protection Agency says, well, yes, we're going to try to regulate it as a pollutant, that's a very worrisome taking over of more power by a government agency. Could it be defunded? Can you take away money from it? Yes, but that requires Congress to vote to defund it. Good luck. I agree. We should be worried when we see more and more and more power being taken by government. That's the theme running through these questions, and it's always a problem. But rejoice, there are some safeguards. There can be legal challenges to that EPA decision, things like that. So.
Well, and I'm just wondering about I don't know if you have the answer, but that how narrowly or broadly did the Supreme Court address that whole lawsuit? I mean, is it just give the EPA full authority to just do whatever they want under that guise, or is it more narrowly defined?
Yeah, I'm afraid it does. It gives a broad foundation for it, but I don't have at my hand the details right now. Okay, anything else? Anything else on this? Okay, Vic?
Just a comment to Meet the Press this morning was talking about government employees. On average, their income is 30% higher than
Vic, you can say it on the microphone.
Just a couple comments this morning on Meet the Press. It's talking about the average government employee's income, 30% higher than what it is in private industry now.
30% higher in government employees than it would be for a comparable job in private industry?
Private industry.
Ooh, that sounds like those African countries I was talking about. All the money's in government work.
And a little tongue-in-cheek is on number 6, if the king only takes 10%, king sounds real good as opposed to 55%.
The king's what?
If the king only takes 10%, a king sounds really good as opposed to
Obama taking 55%. Well, okay. So, I mean, what I'm hearing from these comments is we're seeing principles for government about restraint of power, separation of power, and all of a sudden we're saying, wait a minute, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about this going on in our society right now, and those things worry me as well. Yeah, yeah, concern me. Okay, let's go on to number 7. Here I have a challenge for myself, and that is I'm going to try to argue that the Bible gives at least indirect support for the idea of a democracy rather than a monarchy. Why is that a challenge? It's because everywhere you look in the Bible, you have kings. This king, this king, this king, here's a king, there's a king, everywhere, king, king. Well, if it just has kings in the Bible, doesn't the Bible support the idea of kings? And for centuries, kings argued this. The divine right of kings. Don't you have a pattern of kings in the Bible and King David and King Solomon and all of this? And that was what they taught to keep people following and obeying them. Here's the Bible. I'm the king. The Bible has kings. Well, here is my argument. First of all, isn't it possible that the Bible reports that we have these kings, but doesn't necessarily endorse that as the ideal form of government? And in fact, can't we see that the pattern of kings generally in the Bible is to abuse their power? Even David, even Solomon, and then certainly the later kings that followed them in the divided monarchy. You had king after king after king being corrupt, very few being righteous and godly. So when we read the narrative examples, are they telling us this is the best form of government? Or are they telling us this is what happened, but you don't necessarily need to use that as your pattern for government? That's one argument from the narrative. Number, and then point one here, the equality of all people in the image of God. Genesis 1:27, the very first verse in the Bible that reports the creation of human beings says, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." So both man and woman are created having this great status of being in the image of God. And that then applies to all human beings following them, because Genesis 9, 5 and 6 that we looked at a couple weeks ago, it talks about man being in the image of God. That's after the flood, and that's talking about human beings generally. And the book of James, James 3, 9, talks about human beings in general being in God's image. But that means we all share that great privilege of being in the image of God, being more like God than anything else on the earth. And if we're all in the image of God, then why? I'm going to pick on Mike Langley because I just see him in the front row here. Why should Mike think that he can be king over everybody just because his dad was king? See, why should we think that anyone... Sorry, Mike, I just had to pick out some example. Now, Mike wouldn't do that, I'm quite sure. But that is, why should we think that any one family has a hereditary right to pass down the kingship to the next generation, the next generation, the next generation? In fact, some people whose history we are very familiar with decided that that whole system was wrong. And they wrote a document that started out this way: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed with their creator with certain unalienable rights." Oh, all men are created equal. That means there's no royal family. That means we don't have to support this system of King George III in England, where he had a monarchy that was hereditary. It was passed down from generation to generation. The United States was founded on the principle that we're going to reject the idea of a king, and we're going to reject the idea of hereditary rule or hereditary monarchy, and we're going to have a different kind of government that says everybody's on the same plane. No royalty. No nobles, no lords, no... what are the other elements of royalty? Of lords? Huh? Lords and, I don't know, other things. Okay, so equality in the image of God. Number two, if you're going to set up a system of government that protects against abuse, number two, accountability of rulers to the people helps prevent a misuse of their power. Oh, really? So, who was in the news this last week? Senator Max Baucus, who, in fact, got a federal prosecuting attorney job for his girlfriend. And when it comes out, he is going to be accountable to the voters in what state is he from?
Montana.
There's an accountability. And that's the safeguard against abuse of power, is accountability. That is, you have to continue to get approval from the voters. Number three, if the government is to serve for the benefit of the people, that is, Romans 13, 4 says he's God's servant for your good. He's a servant of God. That is, he's to do you good. Well, then, who's to decide what is good for the people? If the government is to serve for the benefit of the people, the government doesn't exist ultimately for the good of the king or the good of the emperor or the good of the ruling council, but it exists for the good of the people themselves. Well, if government should exist for the good of the people, then who should best decide whether the government is doing you good or not? How about you deciding? See, and that gives some principle that would lean toward letting people choose their own rulers. And number four, there's a narrative pattern where government seems in the Bible... government seems to work best with the consent of those who are governed. So in Exodus 4, 29 to 31, God had called Moses to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt. But then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. And Aaron spoke the words the Lord had spoken to Moses and did signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel. That is, they came and got consent or support or affirmation from the elders and therefore then from the people themselves. Or 1 Samuel 5, Samuel stands before the people and is acknowledged as judge. Or in 2 Samuel 2, 4, when David had been appointed by God to be king, he still sought the consent of the people. So 2 Samuel 2, 4, and the men of Judah came and there they anointed David king over the house of Israel. And 1 Kings 1:39, we have another example of this, where a king, this will be Solomon, 1 Kings 1:39, there Zadok the priest took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. Then they blew the trumpet and all the people said, "Long live King Solomon." So there's a pattern where these kings, even though God chooses them, they have to get the kind of consent of the people. They stand before the people and all the people say, "Long live the king." Interesting. And by contrast, note 1 Kings 12, where you have, after Solomon dies, 1 Kings 12:15 to 16, the king did not listen to the people. This is Rehoboam. For it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word. So God is beginning to bring judgment on the nation. The king didn't listen to the people, and of course there's disaster because the nation then is divided. So it seems that there's a narrative pattern where government works best with the consent of the people. That would favor a democracy of some sort, where there's a vote of the people to affirm their leaders. So those arguments, equality of people in the image of God, so no royal family. Number two, accountability of people, rulers to the people, prevents a misuse of power. Number three, the people are the best judge of whether the government is doing them good like it's supposed to. And number four, government works best with the consent of the people. Those would be arguments where I would say the Bible gives principles that seem to me to support some kind of democracy. And so, the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, and then here's this phrase, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So here in 1776, we've got this idea. Government should be accountable to the people. It's the idea that's foundational to some sort of democracy. It goes back to the Mayflower Compact, 1620, where these Christians fleeing from England, where they didn't have freedom of religion, they form voluntarily an agreement by which they agree to be subject to the laws of the Massachusetts Bay Colony the Plymouth Colony that they establish. So they say, we give consent to the government. Now, it seems to me if you're going to choose some kind of government, what are your options? You can have a monarchy where the king and his son and his son and his son all rule. Well, that doesn't seem like a good system. Too much corruption, denial of the image of God among all people. You can have a dictatorship where just whoever has the most guns takes over. That's rule by power or force. And if you don't like that, you can have no government. Well, that's anarchy and crime abounds. What's your other option? Government by the consent of the governed. And it seems to me that that is the best kind of government among the choices that we have as options. Does that help? And so in 1776, we had one national democracy established, the United States. By 1950, 22 countries of the world were democracies, 22 by 1950. By 2000, 120 of the 192 countries of the world, 58% of the population of the world under some kind of democracy. So the idea, beginning in 1776, began to spread. It's not evident on the surface of this verse or that in the Bible. You've got to kind of take these general principles. So I can understand how people for a long time thought, hey, we should have kings. But it seems to be a more mature understanding of the principles of the Bible concerning government. Now, one point. What about the word democracy? Again and again, people have said to me, we're not a democracy in the United States. We're a republic. And what they mean by that is that we have a government. We don't have a government where everybody votes on everything. We have a government of elected representatives. And technically, they want to call that a republic. I understand that. I agree that we are a republic. But when I look up the word democracy in my American Heritage Dictionary, it says government by the people exercised either directly or through elected representatives. So it seems like that's meaning number one. That's the ordinary sense of the word, where there are elections and the representatives carry out the government. That's a special kind of democracy called a republic, but it is a democracy. It falls in the general broad category of democracy, government by the people, exercised either directly or through elected representatives. So I am happy calling the United States a democracy. That is, it's government by elected representatives rather than by a monarchy. That's just a little saying. I'm using the word in a common sense today. Well, I have point eight to do. Government should safeguard human freedom and human liberty. That's going to take a few minutes. And then number nine, nations should value patriotism. Really? Should we be patriotic and support our nation? I think so. That is for next week because I ran out of time. And then the third thing I have to do is that little supplemental material on is it ever right to disobey government and was the American Revolution justified? That's all coming next week.